Hi, this is Patricia Lee Stotter and Marcia Rock with the Project Service. Today I'm going to be speaking with Christina M. Roof, who's the National Acting Legislative Director for AMVETS. In other words, ladies, veterans, she has your back on the Hill in D.C. Now, whether Christina is presenting testimony to the U.S. House of Representatives or addressing a variety of federal agencies, she is there for you. She hails from a family steeped in military tradition. She wasn't able to join the military herself for medical reasons, so she has chosen to serve her country by serving those who serve. Well, Christina, maybe God works in mysterious ways, because you do the most amazing work advocating for our veterans, and I want to thank you for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
So let me start by asking you about the AMVETS 2011 legislative agenda. I know that one of your responsibilities in that includes actively identifying current issues and concerns. So I wonder if you could tell us what your primary objectives are and how they apply in particular to our subgroup of veterans, disabled female veterans in transition.
Absolutely. Well, just this year, we're continuing our annual tradition with this latest publication, offering the new Congress and VETS members and concerned veterans and service members kind of a comprehensive explanation on how AMVETS will work on their behalf. Our AMVETS members play a critical role in molding our legislative agenda each year, whether it be through side conversations or issues identified in all resolutions that are voted on by our membership each year. We take all that into consideration when compiling this. For 2011, our top legislative priorities include improving services for women veterans and service members, increasing outreach and access for rural and remote veterans, improving the screening and treatment process for veterans suffering with traumatic brain injuries and PTSD, and also closing the funding and automation loopholes in VA prosthetic and sensory aid services. And lastly, of course, is improving the overall transition process, which includes education benefits, and the claims backlog, employment, and so on. When you deal with veterans' issues, they're not always necessarily gender-specific. However, we know that there are a lot of issues that are not being addressed or are slowly being addressed that do address women in particular. That's why this year's legislative agenda, our top priority, is for women veterans and service members. We are going to reach out to VA and DOD. That's something that's great about AMVETS. Our membership is composed of both veterans and active duty service members. So we get to deal with both DOD and VA, which is key because you need both agencies to work together.
And in particular, many of them have been frustrated in their efforts to get treatment for PTSD and MST, military sexual trauma. And one woman actually wrote, and I'm going to quote what she said, quote, "It's typical for all government agencies to diagnose access to and personality disorders to not qualify us for benefits and care under VA or SSA. Now, it's always a bit like an alphabet soup, but to say what she's saying, I know you get it. A, these women are having some trouble getting their benefits, and then in acute situations, they're having some trouble actually getting into the hospital for emergency emotional care, like if they're feeling suicidal or they're having a crisis about military sexual trauma. Can you give some of the people listening to this podcast suggestions for how to best get their benefits and what to do in an emergency situation?
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, we're kind of addressing two different things here. First is getting enrolled within the VA healthcare system. And now, since laws have been updated, you can actually do that online. You go to www.va.gov, and you follow the healthcare links until you get to a form called 1010EZ. And that what that's going to do is start your enrollment process to get you enrolled into the VA healthcare system. It's also going to help you locate your nearest provider and so on. So that's how the initial steps. And, you know, even if you've been out for a while, this isn't something that had to be done, you know, right after your service was over. This is something you can do at any time if you are a veteran. Whether you're qualified, you know, obviously I'm not qualified to address that for every single person, but that's going to be your first step. And if you feel like you need help doing that process with the form and the enrollment process, again, go to VA's website or just even get out the phone book and call your nearest VA facility, and they will help walk you through it. Now, when it comes to urgent-type situations, anytime, if you're enrolled in VA or not, if you're having any type of mental health emergency, you need to go to the nearest emergency room. I don't care if it's a VA or if it's a private sector. If it's truly an emergency and you are enrolled in VA, yet you don't have the means to get to that VA medical center, VA will reimburse the private sector hospital. Depending on what part of the country you're in, many VA facilities have walk-in urgent care clinics and emergency rooms. But again, if you don't have access to that and it is a true emergency, go to your nearest local private sector hospital for care.
That's great to know, because many of our women have assumed that wasn't the case. And so that's a very great pragmatic suggestion. Back to the issue of just getting your benefits. Another woman who contacted us made the following statement, and I would like to know if, A, this is true, and if it is, what your advice is. And she said, I'm quoting her, "During a review of 750 veterans' claims, the Inspector General found that one of the primary reasons that more male veterans were granted disability compensation than female veterans was due to a regulation that the service member was required to have been in combat, earned a combat badge, or ribbon." Now, so that's what this woman veteran wrote us. I'd like you to respond to it. Tell us if it's true, and if it is true, what's being done about it?
Well, yes, it's true, absolutely. Or I should say it was true up until July 13th of 2010. The way Title 38 regulations were outlined regarding mental health and PTSD factors in determining whether you could have a disability rating for PTSD, the way it was written before is you had to have served in direct combat. Obviously, with the changing war tactics, there being no real borders and no real clear enemy in these latest conflicts, and that's, and countless other VSOs and individual advocates went to VA and said, listen, you know, we need to update this regulation to truly reflect the needs of our military service members today. Because in the military, you're given what's an MOS, and that's kind of like your job. You're assigned in the military. However, still, and this is actually in March, is going to come out a report on this, there are 10% of assignments that are closed to women. And these 10% of assignments are all combat-related. So what they were running into and what this woman might be referring to is even if she was deployed in a combat zone, if she wasn't assigned to a certain unit or brigade that was routinely engaging the enemy, then she wouldn't have qualified under old regulations. What she would have had to do is she would have had to go back and find people she served with, get written statements validating that certain things could have happened and so on. Just things that are absolutely unacceptable, and that's in my personal opinion. For someone to come forward and actually seek the help they need for something they've been through, hard enough. And so we felt asking them to go and find members that they served with to revalidate what they were asking for help with just wasn't okay. It was just another hurdle and barrier to care. So as of July 13, 2010, that regulation was finally changed and updated. And what it's saying is that, well, one, it redefines combat zones. It also redefines who qualifies. And in a nutshell, you know, you don't have to necessarily be the, you know, the Marine kicking in the door and clearing houses to qualify for PTSD. If you were running convoys and you were ever in fear for your life, that's going to be enough to open up the claim and for them to start looking into it and getting you help.
That is such great news. And in particular, you're pointing out that it's hard enough for people to ask for the help they need, let alone go refine and interview their friends to prove their need. I think that's extremely insightful, and it's terrific that this has gone in this better direction. In light of this, Christina, what do people do who have had a claim for PTSD denied in the past?
Well, first, and this is what I always tell people, never try to file a claim by yourself. Go to a claims officer. AMBETS offers free claims. Veteran Service officers, they will file your claim. They will walk you through it. They will do the forms. They will take all the headache out of the claims process for you. Whether it's a new claim or an old claim, whether it's for PTSD or anything else, use a free Veteran Service officer. Most of them can even be found within VA medical centers. Now, that being said, if you've been denied a claim for PTSD in the past due to something in that regulation, what VA recommended is that you refile your claim, because they're actually going back through claims starting, I think, post-Vietnam, going all the way back through and revisiting these claims. And if your claim is approved, you will actually be retroactively paid for the months or years that you did not receive the disability payment that you should have been receiving.
Well, that is so wonderful and so huge and so great that we're going to make a point of linking on our website directly to the AMVETS service you were talking about. And speaking about the wonderful work AMVETS does, we've known for a long time through some of the ladies who've been involved in our project and many others about the passionate and effective work you've done helping people get service dogs to help with their invisible as well as their visible injuries. Yet I'm still hearing stories about our warriors having difficulty, our veterans getting into places with their dogs, even veterans hospitals. And I wonder if you could tell us, bring us up to speed on what's happening now and what you recommend to people who find themselves in this situation?
Absolutely. Yes, AMVETS, we've been working very, very hard on service dog regulations that were, you know, they were published in 2001, but no one really held VA accountable to upholding those regulations regarding benefits until, you know, finally enough of us got together and we said, hey, wait a minute, you know, why aren't these benefits being paid? When we first got involved in this, it was March of 2009. Now, when I say we, I mean myself playing an active role with AMVETS. AMVETS actually has been working with the service dog industry for 27 years. But myself personally, when I got involved in this in March of 2009, it came to my attention that VA had only approved 8 veterans since 2001 to receive their service dog benefits. Because when it comes to VA and benefits, VA views a service dog as a prosthetic device, which when I first heard, I was like, no, that is a living, breathing animal. It's not a device. But when you really get down to it and look at what the service dog functions to do, it in a way is a prosthetic device. So what we started doing is going to VA and VHA leadership and saying, help us understand what what's not happening here? How can we help you help these veterans? And what it came down to was just pretty much a general misunderstanding and kind of not knowing where to go or what to do. And that's where we stepped in. We started putting things on our website, on our blog, presenting information at defense symposiums. Any place where we could touch the public, we wanted to bring this voice. And so we started going out and telling veterans, you know what, if you have a service dog, whether that service dog has ever been approved by VA, whether that service dog is for a service-connected disability or not, it doesn't matter. Here are the benefits available to you.
I understand your point about the prosthetic device completely, but this particular prosthetic device eats kibble, needs puppy shots, needs vaccinations, needs checkups, needs check back in with your service dog organization every 2 years and bring your dog back up to speed on the training. Some of our veterans are complaining that they're having difficulty with the upkeep of this very animated prosthetic device that they have. So is that included?
Now, when it comes to what VA will pay for, and again, this is from memory, so if I do misstate something, I apologize, but they are going to provide reimbursement for the upkeep of your prosthetic device, such as annual dental cleanings, prescription medications, checkups. Now, they're not going to pay for food. They're not going to pay for things like grooming and toys. And they're not going to pay for over-the-counter type supplements or medications. However, they are going to pay, again, for the prescription medication. Now, they will pay for food if the food is prescribed by a vet, by a veterinarian, because it's a certain type of food that dog needs to be on.
Is anything happening with paying for the training of these dogs? Because I know it's all donated money now, and it can be up to $20,000.
Well, as of right now, no. But when you really get into this, on the surface, it looks like service dogs. You know, not that big of an issue. Even I thought that going into it, I'm like, oh, I can fix this. It's not a big deal. You know, and to a certain extent, we thought we had kind of fixed it when we, just from our AMBUS getting involved, we went from 8 veterans to 150 veterans being approved within 2 months. We know the huge number. That's what we were able to help do in 2 months, what VA couldn't do in 8 years. Now they are getting better and things are moving along, but now our next fight in this, I should say, is getting a regulation on access change. And Marcia, I will get to your question there in just a second. But as regulation stands right now in Title 38, Part 1, it's actually subsection 1.218, if anyone's interested. What it says is that dogs and other animals, except seeing eye dogs, shall not be brought upon property except as authorized by the head of the facility or designee. I'm suggesting towards earlier, that policy is a huge burden to veterans. We've encountered it with numerous women that you know, numerous AMVETS members who have called us and said, I just went to my local VAMC to get my spinal cord care, and they told me I couldn't come in. And when I asked them why, they said, you cannot bring a dog in here. Well, there's where the problem starts. These veterans that I'm referring to right now are receiving regular benefits under Title 38 for the prosthetic device, i.e. dog, in this case, yet they can't bring the prosthetic device into the facility to get their health care. What we want, what AMVETS wants, is we want this regulation that hasn't been updated since 1984 to be updated again, like the PTSD regulation, to reflect the needs of current veterans. So what we'd like to see happen is a regulation to be changed to something about where it says except seeing eye dogs. Well, one, we'd like the wording to be correct and for it to say guide dogs, but we'd also like it to say, and service dogs as recognized by the Department of Veterans Affairs. Because, again, if a veteran was living in Michigan and they were going to their regular care and bringing their dog in, everything was fine. But let's say for an employment reason, they had to move to Tennessee. And so no one ever told them that that regulation wasn't across the board, so they go to Tennessee to get their health care, and then they're turned away because they have a prosthetic device.
Some people from some of the training organizations have been frustrated that a veteran will get a prescription for a service dog, and yet so far the VA will not pay for the training of the dog. Is that something that you're looking to address?
Well, as of right now, the way this stands, and you guys, you both know me, and I don't usually share a lot of personal stuff, but in this case, I kind of feel like I need to, because I'm able to now see this issue from a personal and a professional level. My father, who is terminally ill, was actually approved for a service dog a few months ago, and now we're in the waiting process. And when I say waiting process, we're in the waiting process of the agency, which is ADI approved, by the way, which is something I advocate for very loudly, making sure that your service dog does come from an ADI accredited agency, because those agencies are going to raise the funds necessary for my dad, for the veteran. It's not going to cost, in most cases, the veteran or even non-veteran a penny out of their pocket. These agencies have been doing this for 40-plus years, and whether VA pays for it or not, they're going to keep doing it. Now, once I think a lot of this primary policy and regulation stuff gets worked out, that's something that can be looked at in the future. But again, as of right now, that's not necessarily something I'm focusing on, because I don't want to jump ahead of the gun. You know, we need to get the regulations changed first. But again, if a service member is in need or interested in a service dog, I want to stress too that they do not have to have a referral from VA. They can go to assistancedogsinternational.org and look for the closest agency to them. You know, and in fact, I would probably call a couple. And then that is the industry expert, not VA, not me, not a lawmaker. The industry experts are going to be able to walk that veteran through what needs to happen.
I have two more issues I want to talk to you about. One is, it's kind of from the sublime to the ridiculous. The sublime is the story of how many women veterans we're meeting who literally feel their lives were saved by getting back to college. And in particular, mm-hmm. by colleges that have programs designed specifically for vets. One of the veterans in our film is at CUNY in the PROVE program, which is a terrific program. There are other schools with good programs. Can people find out about schools with good programs through AMVETS, programs that support vets who are going to college?
Absolutely. They can go to our website, AMVETS.org, and there'll be a link on there where it'll click, and it'll link you to schools that we have personal experience with working with. Also, believe it or not, on VA's website, there's also schools that are listed. Again, just because it's not on one of our lists doesn't mean it's not a good school and it doesn't have a program. Those are just the ones that we're familiar with. There are several brilliant programs out there right now, such as a program up in Ohio called the SERVE program, where it's not only providing a counselor or social worker, per se, for veterans, but it's actually setting up classes that are composed strictly of veterans. And then they slowly move you out of those classes into other classes. But the transition process can be such a culture shock. You know, if you go into the military when you're 18, 19 years old, and then you get out, whether it be 4 years later or 10 years later, how the average civilian has lived their life to how you lived your life is like night and day. So to simply to leave military culture and military life and just to go onto a college campus without having any type of support system in place What we're seeing in the numbers is that the dropout rate is so much higher than on campuses that have programs for veterans.
That's a great point. As you know, before I got involved with service, I was working with the PROVE program at City University of New York, and these programs are wonderful. And I found that the veterans, men and women, that I met there, veterans who are back in school, that while the transition is a difficult one, these are some very high-functioning vets who are doing very, very well. And then there are the vets we've met on the other end of the continuum, and that's homeless women, sometimes with children. And I'm wondering if what AmVets is doing to advocate for those people.
AmVets actually, for the past few years, has been working directly with the Department of Veterans Affairs Initiative on Homelessness, trying to help develop these programs, going around the country and touring to see what's currently going on, to what needs to be fixed. And VA has made strides in the past few years addressing this, especially when it comes to women veterans. Because the fact of the matter is that women are serving at rates that, I mean, you figure 2% during Vietnam, that was the average military population, to as of 2010, women composed 14.6 of the military population. That's a huge change. And sadly, between Vietnam and the first Desert Storm, a lot of benefits and programs failed to kind of keep updating and to keep addressing the changing needs of veterans, in this case, especially women. And now that women are serving at such rates, they're coming back and finding that the programs they need and the support systems aren't always in place. And so I think a common misconception for people, before I talk about, you know, solutions to the homeless problem and what we're doing, is just because a veteran is homeless does not mean they were an alcoholic. It does not mean they did drugs. It does not mean they were lazy and didn't go out to get a job. These are people that are simply falling through the cracks, and that's what we have got to stop. And again, that begins with prevention services, housing support services, employment training. So we can try to stop this before it gets any worse. Because Patty Marsha, quite frankly, there's parts of this country where the women's homeless population, veteran population, is larger than that of their male counterparts. Most of them are geared towards men.
We're quite aware of that. We have found, again, the privately funded Band-Aids, whether it's Jericho Project or one which is within a VA, the Arara Center at the West Haven VA, which is fantastic, that what you're talking about, just these women who have fallen through the safety net, and they're spectacular women, and it's just completely unacceptable that these amazing women who have put their lives on the line find themselves in this situation.
No, you're right, and thank God for programs like Jericho, because without those types of programs, I mean, a lot of these women wouldn't have made it, let's just put it that way. But I am happy to say that VA has, over the past couple years, put a lot more money, a lot more initiative, hired a lot more people to address homelessness. And also something I want to say real quick to you is, if you're a homeless veteran, let's just say you're a homeless woman veteran, and you need help, please, please, please go to your nearest healthcare facility. Just walk in the door. You don't have to be enrolled in VA. You don't even have to have ever been there. Walk in the front door. Walk to the desk and say, I need to see the VA homeless coordinator, or I need to see the social work department, or I need to see the women's veterans program manager. Any of these contacts are going to be able to sit down and help you immediately and get you set up with whether it be VA or private organizations like Jericho to get you the resources and options you need immediately. You had said something about women with children. I think a lot of women that have children are afraid to reach out for help. which is understandable because they think that, you know, well, the city or the government's going to come in and they're going to take my children, which I can understand that. However, that's not always the case. Again, go to a VA facility or go to a private organization in your area and ask for help. Nobody is going to take your children from you. They're going to look to help you and get you, they're going to make you safe.
I have another question for you. When I introduced you, I talked about how you had our veterans' backs on Capitol Hill, which I think can be a daunting theater of battle. And I cannot tell you how much I respect you for going on that turf.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up because I've actually been having a lot of side conversations with individuals on this. As of January 6th, I think it was, when the new members of Congress in the Senate were sworn in, we now have started the 112th Congress. The turnover in representatives is the biggest this country has seen since the 1940s. So it is so important that everyone get involved on their local levels, on the state levels, because as of right now, there's not a whole lot of veteran legislation that's been introduced. There is a little bit, but not a lot. So this is the best time for people to go or call their local congressman or senator, say, I'd like to sit down with you, or, you know, here I'm a veteran of so-and-so conflict. This is what's important to me. And then make them answer you. You guys elected, we elect these people to office, and they're there to serve their constituents, us. And so veterans can literally shape the 112th Congress by getting involved on the local level, because that is where everything starts, at the state, county, whatever local level gets to state, and then it comes to D.C. where I can get involved. I can only fight for what you guys get here. So you have a voice. Remember, you elected these people to office. Now hold them accountable to meeting your needs and introducing legislation.
Well, I think your point that we voted these people into office and that we should hold them accountable, I urge every single person listening to this podcast who's happy or unhappy with what's going on to become vocal about what you need so that people like Christina can advocate for you on the Hill to people who know what you want and need. And Christina, I want to tell you, first of all, I want to thank you for speaking with us and let you know that the work you do for veterans is amazing. And since you got personal, I'm going to get personal. I am a military mom, and I feel a lot better knowing that you're there for my son. Thanks, Christina.
No, thank you very much, and thank you for being a military mom and sharing your son with this country. Thank you.